Here's what I want you to do right now for me, everybody. Number one, take a deep breath. Number two, take another one, will you? Because it's going to be all right, I promise. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday at the end of what sort of became a very long week, didn't it? The 21st of August. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The list of things to talk about as we regroup is long. It starts with China, detours through Europe, winds up for us today, anyway, on Wall Street. Maybe that's the end of it. Maybe it's not. I don't know. That's how capitalism works. With us on this Friday are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Hey, everybody.
Hi, hey, Kai.
All right, so now that I've promised, Cardiff, that everything's going to be all right, what do you think of my basic thesis, that it's, you know, this is not the end of the world?
It's definitely not the end of the world, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be a little bit worried. What I'd note is that markets reflect not just what's happened, but what's going to happen. They reflect their own expectations of the future. And a lot of the slowdown that's happened this year was expected, but maybe not the extent of it. In other words, we knew that some parts of the world were going to slow down, notably China and other emerging markets. We just didn't know they would slow down this much. And now they're essentially repricing. They're reflecting updated expectations of what's going to happen next.
Lee, China almost literally repriced 10 days ago with the devaluation of the yuan. Do you think that was the start of everybody going, oh, no?
I think that was. The market, that was a surprise move, yeah. And the markets do not like surprises. And if the markets really shrugged off the plunges in the China stock market for a couple of them until that happened. And then I do think that was sort of what set everything else off. And then you have, oil going below 40 today, and you've got not just China, but Brazil and Russia and lots of other places. As Cardiff is saying, this unease globally is kind of scary.
Cardiff, bring it back home then. How are we doing? I mean, we're doing all right, right? We're adding jobs. GDP is growing, not as much as we want to, but, it's not terrible here.
I think you're right. And let's keep in mind also that there are some mechanisms at play here that sort of buffer things for the U.S. The U.S. is a relatively closed economy, which is to say for instance, relative to a lot of other advanced economies, a lot of U.S. activity happens within our own borders. And so, for instance, when commodity prices fall, all right, that acts as a kind of a buffering effect. So in terms of the broader story for the U.S. economy, we're still adding jobs at a decent clip. Wages aren't going much higher. And there's a lot of uncertainty about what economic policy is going to do next. But at the same time, it's kind of a stagnant, steady, progressive story, one that really hasn't been much different for the last few years.
Lee, how much of a factor for you in thinking about the future is the speed with which everything kind of came off the rails in the last 10 days?
It was pretty sudden. And after, so many months and years of steady increases, and I think one of the most striking things is how the tech sector got hit. Mm-hmm. In particular, you look at what happened to Apple, which has been getting hit much harder than the rest of the market. And that is very U.S.-based. That is some serious fears happening. And I think it's not unlinked to China as well, because the tech sector and China are linked. They have to be.
Ought to point out here, Cardiff, that a little letting the air out of a market that's been going like ours has is not a terrible thing.
It's not a terrible thing, and it's good to remind investors sometimes that they just can't ride the wave all the time. They actually have to do their homework, that there's no such thing as a guaranteed return. If you're going to get a higher return, you're going to have to take a little bit more risk. That's how markets work. So every once in a while, the thing's going to have to go down. That's just normal part of the capital allocation process. It's a normal part of what markets do. So you're right in that sense. Take a deep breath. You're not going to, you're not going to lose your life savings here.
Capital allocation. It sounds so technical. All right. I'm going to do something with you guys in the next minute and 3 seconds that we have left that I do with CEOs sometimes. I ask them to say in 5 words or less what their company does. I want you to tell me in 5 words or less what Janet Yellen is thinking today. Cardiff, you get to go first.
Janet Yellen.
Yep. Live
what
radio.
What am I going to do next?
What am I going to do? That's six, but that's really good. That's really good.
All right. What
that's
next?
Really good. What am I going to do? All right, good.
This is like Lee? A haiku. I love this. let's see. I knew as of last week.
last week. Oh,
maybe
that's,
she's
that's
thinking,
six as well.
I think I'll wait instead.
There we go.
Yes, there you go. I think I'll wait instead. I'm going with that one. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a good weekend. Monday on Wall Street is going to be interesting. That is about the best thing to say about anything that happened today. So listen, take a minute. Send us your five words on what you think Janet Yellen is thinking today. Hit us up on Facebook if you like. We're Marketplace APN there. You can get us on Twitter as well. We're at Marketplace. As for the rest of it, yeah, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are almost 100 big active wildfires going on right now across the country, most of them obviously out west. They've already burned up more than 7 million acres, hundreds of homes and buildings, and as a result, we are running out of people to fight them. About 200 soldiers have been called in to fight the fires in the west, the first such deployment in almost 10 years. The need for firefighters has gotten so great that Washington's Department of Natural Resources has for the first time ever begun accepting offers from people hoping to help fight the fires or to donate equipment. Small-town volunteer firefighters are one thing. Massive, fast-moving wildfires that trained professionals have trouble containing, those are entirely another. Marketplace's Andy Euler picks it up from there.
Talk to anybody up in central Washington right now, and they'll tell you. These fires are burning exceptionally hot and spreading really fast. Joe Smiley is spokesman for Washington's Department of Natural Resources.
We're stretched thin throughout Washington and Oregon, fighting fires as they start, and they keep spreading.
And the people of Washington get it. They wanted to volunteer to help. So just this week, the state decided to allow people that wanted to volunteer to fight the fires to come forward.
Our phone box got overloaded. His phone actually shut down for a bit. He listened to 29 voicemails, and in that time had another 18 arrive.
But even though Washington is strapped for manpower, not everyone who volunteers is going to be out there on the front line. Bridget Smith is with Washington's State Board for Volunteer Firefighters.
It's not like they get paychecks, per se, but they do go through many of the same requirements and many of the same checks that, say, a career firefighter would go through.
That means a background check and a physical. Smith says all volunteer firefighters have to get insurance from the state as well. Roy Reiber is a fire commissioner in Okanagan County, the site of the most devastating fire active right now. He was a volunteer firefighter himself for 26 years and says having all these volunteers is good, but might be a blessing and a curse.
It certainly would be, because you have to put your more experienced guys keeping people out of trouble.
The Department of Natural Resources admits this is something of an experiment. If it works, and everyone stays safe, they say it might be an example of how to combat limited manpower under the strain of a disaster. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Well, the past couple of weeks in the global economy have brought to mind memories of the financial crisis, and let me pause for just a minute here to say once again that it is not. We still do tend to signpost things by reference to the Great Recession, and there is news from the world of consumer credit along those lines. According to Fair Isaac Corporation, or FICO for short, the average FICO credit score is now 695, the highest that average has been in a decade. Marketplace's Gigi Duban explains what might be going on here.
Basic money management, or how not to be broke. Pay your bills on time. Pay down that credit card debt. And seriously, do you really need those $300 boots? Everyone's heard it. Now, people are actually doing these things.
People have been saving money, putting money in the bank, and being more careful about their use of money.
Ed Merzwinski is a consumer advocate with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. He says it's a lot easier now to know what's going on with your credit. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been pushing banks and creditors to give credit scores away for free. This week, American Express joined other big credit cards in making FICOs available to cardholders.
And that may be helping to educate more consumers.
But there could be something else boosting credit scores. Since the economy tanked, a lot of people have given up on credit. Rod Griffin is director of public education at Experian.
The economy was so poor for so long that people were reluctant to take on debt, to engage in credit use.
A lot of credit card dropouts are millennials. Carly Urban teaches economics at Montana State University.
So I don't know if this is young adults seeing their parents go through some type of financial trauma or if it's just them being a little bit more risk averse.
Griffin says millennials' reluctance to use credit cards might work against them. Hard to build good credit when you don't use credit. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
We talked about oil just a bit up in the wrap, Lee Gallagher did. And with the fall in crude prices the past year or so, have come hard times out in the oil patch. Hard times for oil companies and hard times for the people who work for them. Because the way to deal with an oil glut, which is what we've got, is to stop drilling for it. Independent producer Todd Melby has been talking to people in the Bakken field in North Dakota as oil peaked a couple of years ago and as it has been falling. Steve Brown is one of those people. He started up a business hauling water to oil rigs a couple of years ago.
I moved here from Lander, Wyoming. I had never been to North Dakota. I knew there was a lot of money to be made up here, you know, and I was in a bind down there in Lander and just needed to get myself out of a bind. So I come up here and stuck my neck out, and I had two trucks, two old water trucks, and it was just me. And it actually got it going pretty good, you know. I mean, we're just small, but we've been going good. We provide a very good service.
Are you worried?
I am a little bit, yeah. Yeah, you know, because we got a lot on the line. You know, I had one company man tell me that they needed to cut by about 10 to 15%. And so that's what we did for them. And then we had them after that, you know, we had them for a couple more months, and then they stacked the rig out. So we don't have them anymore. So we've had to bring our prices down. We've done that, and of course, we always do whatever it takes to stay alive and keep proceeding forward. This summer's going to be is going to tell us. If we end up losing a couple more rigs, then I'm going to have to lay some people off. Yeah.
So what do you think is going to happen?
Well, there's a lot of people out there speculating, but we just hope for the best and that these prices will finally come back and, you know, they'll go back to drilling again. You know, we're just going to try to ride the tide out.
Todd Melby's series is called Black Gold Boom. It's an initiative of Prairie Public and the Association of Independents in Radio. Todd spoke to Steve Brown today about how things are going. He said he's hanging on. Coming up.
And when people started donating money, I was frankly shocked.
Because you know what? Some interesting stuff does get funded on the internet. But first, let's do the numbers. There you go. Now it's 2 days in a row. The Dow Industrial's off 530 points, 3%, closed at 16,459. The NASDAQ dropped 171, 3.5%, 4706. The S&P 500 fell 64 points, 3%. 1970 there. For the week, the Dow off 5.8%, the NASDAQ down 6.75%, the S&P 500 lost 5.75%. Yes, the Dow is technically in a correction, but I'm obliged to point out here, it has been a six-year rally, y'all. Some individual stocks for the week. Amazon retreated 7%. Google undid itself 6.5% lower. Apple deleted 8.5%. Facebook, it took off nearly 9%. And those companies are the high flyers, by the by, that kept the indices up the past year or so. And there are some beaten down energy stocks, too, which have held the indices back. The beating goes on for the day. Phillips 66 down 4.7%. Chevron off 4.4%. Bond prices rose because all that money's got to go someplace. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.05%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A couple of years ago, Jim Burris at a WABE in Atlanta did a story for us about a new kind of crowdfunding. Georgia was one of the first states that was going to let regular investors, and not just rich people, buy directly into local businesses. It's a model called equity-based crowdfunding, and Jim's story was about an unconventional startup, a guitar company called Bohemian Guitars. Jim went back the other day to see how things worked out.
These days, you might spot a Bohemian guitar on the shelves of a mass-market music retailer, or in the hands of a big-name performer, drawn by the unique sound and look. The guitar's body is a metal oil can. Just a few years ago, Sean Lee and his brother Adam ran Bohemian's office, assembly line, warehouse, all from Dad's basement. But Sean had big plans.
Initially, I was like, oh yeah, we're going to do guitars and basses and ukuleles, and I quickly realized, let's get one product perfect.
A successful Kickstarter campaign pulled them from basement to big time. They now consider their guitar perfection. And Sean's dream of a bass and ukulele is becoming reality. He hopes the folks here at this Atlanta launch party will be so captivated, they'll pluck down cash and pre-order one of Bohemian's new instruments. But getting to this point meant taking a chance on an unproven concept 2 years ago. Bohemian Guitars became the poster child for equity-based crowdfunding.
We had this really great title now. We were the first company to raise funds in this manner, you know, in however many decades.
Nearly 8 decades. See, after the Great Depression, federal regulations largely prevented the non-affluent from buying equity in small local businesses. But a little-known Georgia law passed in 2011 made it possible for any state resident to invest, just like the high rollers.
There was a lot of energy and a lot of buzz that got generated from that campaign.
That's Jeff Bacarius. His Atlanta startup Spark Market was poised to raise Bohemian $200,000. It worked, but it wasn't easy.
It's a major educational effort.
Spark Market folks spent a lot of time explaining the concept, and say Mom and Pop Coffee Shop Incorporated showed interest? Well, old Ma and Pa had to consider quite a bit, like redoing bylaws, choosing a return big enough to woo money out of investors' wallets, and even who gets power, like a vote on important decisions.
And this scares a lot of businesses because they think to themselves, I'm going to have 50 new investors. I already have a hard enough time, you know, managing my friends and family who are owners of the coffee shops.
Bacarius says those barriers are why Georgia's only seen about 50 or 60 equity-based crowdfunding attempts. You can count on one, maybe two hands, the number of successes. But the concept's biggest cheerleader says equity-based crowdfunding is gaining broader support.
When we were here 2 years ago, there were only 2 states in the union where you could do this.
Now, it's 28. Looking back, with ukulele in hand, Bohemian guitar Sean Lee says the exposure of launching with Spark Market made sense.
But was it the best way to raise money? Maybe not.
Which is why the brothers went back to regular old crowdfunding for their next phase. They're raising money one Indiegogo supporter and one ukulele at a time. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
As we're seeing almost by the day, the future of television isn't actually on television. It's online, and often in tiny little doses. For every house of cards out there, there is a dozen smaller, as in just a couple of minutes per episode, web series that have devoted followings. One of them was an amazingly successful show called The Guild, created by and starring Felicia Day. Day got started on YouTube before being a YouTube star was a thing. She then rolled that over into a web content company called Geek and Sundry. She's got a new book out about the whole thing. It's called You're Never Weird on the Internet, Almost. Felicia, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me here.
Tell me about World of Warcraft, because I think that's where this whole thing kind of starts.
Well, World of Warcraft is a MMORPG, which is a massively multiplayer online role-playing game.
Got it.
And it is a place where millions of people all over the world log on and play together or alone in a virtual world.
And transformative in your life, yes?
Very transformative for me personally, because it inspired me to start writing, and I created a show based on gamers, called The Guild. I wrote it as a TV pilot, and no one wanted to make it because no one understood video games. And a friend of mine had been making sketches for this new online service called YouTube, where people could watch videos online, which was surprisingly, it was actually not regular back then to watch anything online.
Because it sort of feels like YouTube has been around forever.
Exactly. It just was immaculately conceived. No, actually, video online was not common. And I was like, okay, I guess maybe we could cut this up into pieces and make it ourselves in our garage. And that's really where everything started.
And you got it somehow funded.
We actually, for the first season, we put a PayPal button up on the website I made myself through a video online tutorial. And I said, I guess maybe this would work. So it was a whim. And when people started donating money, I was frankly shocked. Someone donated $300 and I emailed them thinking, hey, was this a mistake in the decimal point?
What is it like for you when you, I mean, you act all the time on the internet, right? You've got a zillion things going on, some of which you play yourself and some of which your characters and all the chance. What's it like for you when you do straight up television?
It is fantastic because I get to just do one job. I mean, I have signed on to the career of a million hats and they're stacked a mile high. And whether it's, you know, marketing, PR, producing, writing, acting, the list is very long because that's kind of what's required of you in the digital world. You can't be a specialist, I think. You have to be very broadly talented in a way. But when I'm on a set, on a TV set, I look around and think of the scale of help they have, like hundreds of people versus two people holding a camera and a boom.
How much do you worry about burnout then when you're doing your digital stuff?
Well, I do talk about that in my book. I have a whole chapter about ending The Guild, which was kind of what made my name something other than just an actress on some TV shows. And turning that into a business where YouTube invested in a bunch of startup companies, and mine was one of them, and trying to get that off the ground. And just the pressures that come with success, because I don't think anyone really talks about the fact that you can struggle as much with the pressures of success as you do the pressures of failure.
Yeah.
But nobody wants to complain about that because it seems like kind of like a jerk thing to do.
How much time do you spend feeding your various social media presences? I mean, you've got like 2.5 million followers on Twitter or something like that. Not that I looked it up. So how much time do you spend feeding that versus creating content? You know what I mean?
I think it goes both ways in a sense. Like I do, especially now, I'm online quite a bit because I have something to talk about and I want to entertain people as I do it. You know, when I want to create something from scratch, I have to sort of shut off all those avenues to me, because I think you have to have that sense of boredom to create something and not have people trying to take pieces of you while you're trying to create something. And I think that's a delicate balance for somebody online. And I think it's a challenge because artists are expected to be online now, no matter what. So it's definitely something you have to go in back and forth between.
Who do you rely on to keep you honest, to keep you right-sized, I guess?
Well, I guess the haters and the trolls. I mean, there's never not a day that I log on and don't have someone say how much they despise me, my face, or my work. And that's just the inevitability of the internet. And I try to think, is this really going to piss somebody off? Is this arrogance? Is this hubris? Because the internet is the first in line to knock you off a pedestal, believe me. And I guess if you want to look at the bright side of a very dark thing, that is a constant that you can always rely on.
You know her from The Guild and Geek & Sundry, and now her new book. It's called You're Never Weird on the Internet, Almost. Felicia Day, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
This final note on the way out today, a peek behind the scenes of sorts of a business and economics radio program on a day that the Dow craters 530 points. I was in the studio earlier today, before the closing bell on Wall Street, I should point out, talking with Adrienne Hill for an interview with her that's going to air on Monday. And at one point, I'm sitting there, and I looked up at the TV monitor, and this is what happened.
All right.
Here we go.
Yes.
In 481. Yeah, we're going that 500. This could be like a 600-point day.
This is an intense day. This could be a 600-point day.
Right? Because they're totally going to sell into the close, right? We got 26 minutes left. And everybody's like, oh, my God, and it's a Friday. Get me out of here. We should totally record that. All right, we ready?
That's how you should start your show.
No, I'm just kidding. She's a good sport. Adrian Hill is. The Dow off 530 points today, 3%. The NASDAQ off 171, 3.5%. The S&P 500 fell 64 points, 3%. 1970 at the close. But remember where I started? Just take a deep breath, all right? Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Sitar Nieves is the senior producer of this radio program. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back here on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you then. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.